Good morning. The Healthcare Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Members, when announcing your presence, please make sure your microphone is on. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Avila.
Here.
Vice Chair Tribuzzi.
Here.
Representatives Altman.
Here.
Ranking Member Brown.
Here.
Representatives Duran.
Here.
Garrison.
Here.
Harding.
Here.
Robinson.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Saroy. Skidmore.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Woodson.
Yeah.
Yarbrough.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sabrina, and members. A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Healthcare Appropriations Subcommittee. Members, please, and those in the audience, please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Members, today we have two member bills on the agenda. We will begin with House Bill 953 by Representative Honchowski, and then we will hear House Bill 7047 by our own committee member, Representative Garrison. First, we will start with Representative Honchowski. You're recognized to present House Bill 953.
Thank you very much, Chair Avila. Good morning, also Vice Chair Tribulsi, Ranking Member Brown, and subcommittee members. Thank you so much for allowing me to present House Bill 953, Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, which is also known as PSI-PACT. So what does this bill do? It would make Florida one of the many compact members in this compact. It would allow licensed psychologists to practice telehealth and conduct temporary in-person practice across state lines without having to become licensed in additional PSI-PACT states. Why is that important? For any of you who've had high school students or know high school students, for example, if they go away to college in another state, this would allow them to continue to keep their same psychologist who they've been working with. So it allows that continuity of care, which is really important in the mental health arena. And that is the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Representative Honchowski. Having presented the bill, members, we're now in questions. Questions. Representative Altman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would watching Dr. Phil be considered telehealth?
Chair.
Representative Honchowski, you're recognized.
Having watched Dr. Phil many, many years ago, my answer would be no.
Members, questions. Are there questions of the sponsor? Are there questions of the sponsor? Seeing no questions of the sponsor and having no amendments, we're now in public testimony. Public testimony, we have Philip Suderman with Americans for Prosperity. Waves in support. Next, we have Scott Brook with Mental Wellness Alliance. You're recognized.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Scott Brook. Nice to see you, Representative. I'm founder and president of the Mental Wellness Networking Alliance in Coral Springs in Broward County. We are adjacent to Parkland, where Representative Honchowski is from. Unfortunately, we were impacted, as you know, February 14, a few years ago. 1 year and 1 month later, a young man took his life as a result of the trauma he experienced from what he saw the year before. Since my mom passed away to suicide many years ago, I decided to start the Mental Wellness Networking Alliance in my community. I am also the mayor of Coral Springs, although I'm not here in that capacity. And I support this bill because there are many students that have left that area and go to schools in other states that might still need the support. So I'm happy to support the bill. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brook. Next, we have Derek McGee. Waves in support. Thank you. And members, that concludes public testimony. We're now in debate. In debate. Is there debate on the bill? Representative Woodson, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep. Munchausky, for coming up with this bill. This is a smart way of dealing with the issues that we're having in mental health. Because if kids leave a city or a county and go somewhere else, the services that they are receiving should be consistent to the point that they can see a psychologist in another place in order to continue not to have a break in service. Therefore, they would be able to continue to prosper and survive. So this is a great bill. I will be voting up on your bill, and I really appreciate you coming up with this important bill, especially during this time that we're dealing with so many issues in mental health. Thank you.
Members, further debate. Is there further debate? Seeing no further debate, Representative Munchausky, you're recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and I just want to thank all the members of this subcommittee, and I want to thank all of the members that we serve with here for really prioritizing mental health in it's my second session, and I've seen nothing but wholehearted support and also funding for mental health, and I just want to say thank you to all of you for that. And with that, I close.
Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Avila?
Yes.
Vice Chair Tribuzzi?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Ranking Member Brown?
Yes.
Representatives Duran?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Harding?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Salzman?
Yes.
Saroy? Skidmore?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Woodson?
Yes.
Yarbrough?
Yes.
14 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Members, by your vote, the bill passes. Please show the bill reported favorably. Members, next we have House Bill 7047 by Representative Garrison. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, members. House Bill 7047 is our Medicaid bill we've been working through a number of different subcommittees. As you know, Medicaid is a healthcare coverage safety net for Florida's low-income, disabled, and elderly residents, and is the second largest part of our state's budget. We shifted to a comprehensive managed care model in 2014 and are now coming to the end of the second round of managed care contracts, which are set to expire in 2014. The bill before you would make changes to Medicaid in a number of ways, but primarily laid out in five primary areas: the procurement process, dental benefits, network adequacy, healthy behaviors program, and workforce development. As it relates to procurement, the bill incentivizes ACA and the Medicaid managed care programs to obtain the best value for taxpayers and better benefit options for Medicaid enrollees by requiring ACA to issue a single statewide procurement instead of individual regional procurements, to negotiate and select plans by region to ensure regional competition, but also allow the agency the flexibility to award statewide contracts if that's the best value for the taxpayer. It reduces the number of regions from 11 to 18 by combining some existing regions with the goal to improve choice and competition. It adjusts the minimum and maximum number of plans in each region to reasonably allocate enrollee volume and make each region equally attractive to bidders, again, with the goal of increasing competition and value to the taxpayer as well as the patient. It provides more accurate and comprehensive utilization data potential providers and redirects automatic enrollment to smaller plans whenever a plan has more than 45% of the region's enrollees to ensure a robust competition. As it regards to dental benefits, this bill would reintegrate dental services with healthcare services, repealing the dental carve-out. Dental services would again be provided by the comprehensive managed care plans rather than separate dental-only plans. This also requires the MMA plans to adopt dental education and incentive programs to increase the use of preventative care and requires ACA to establish additional performance measures. As it relates to network adequacy, this bill would require ACA to regularly test plan provider networks to ensure real access to care, not just access on a piece of paper. It increases enrollee access to essential statewide providers by requiring plans to contract with Florida's preeminent cancer hospitals, specifically Moffitt and Sylvester. And for essential providers who receive supplemental Medicaid payments, the bill makes receipt of these payments conditioned on having network contracts in place with the Medicaid plans in their region. The current process makes these supplemental payments conditioned on providers making offers to contract, and where there's no agreement, instructs ACA to make a determination of whether or not there's bad faith. The goal of this proposed change is to ensure that each of Florida's Medicaid recipients have full access to the services of essential health providers who we authorize to receive additional public monies to provide financial benefits from supplemental payments. and also provide clear objective standards for ACA to use in administering the Medicaid and supplemental payment programs. As it relates to healthy behavior programs, this bill would expand the plan's healthy behavior program criteria to address all forms of tobacco use, not just smoking, and to also ensure the substance abuse components focus on addressing opioid abuse. Regarding workforce, it counts plan investments in building all kinds of healthcare workforce for the Medicaid program towards the plan's medical loss ratio and allows plans to offset rebates to the state by those expenditures, thereby encouraging the plans to invest in other occupations to build our workforce pipeline, specifically CNAs, home health aides, LPNs, RNs, so we desperately need them all. And lastly, it also cleans up the Medicaid statutes by removing some obsolete provisions. There's a lot in this bill, members, and I encourage you, if you haven't already, to dive into the staff analysis. It's very comprehensive and provides a treasure trove of information regarding state's Medicaid plan, and with that, that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Garrison. Having presented the bill, members, we're now in questions. Are there questions of the sponsor? Ranking Member Brown, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have just a few questions, if you don't mind.
You're recognized.
And thank you, and thank you, Representative Garrison, for bringing this good bill forward. One of the questions I have is looking at the provision requiring hospitals to contract with all of our medical plans. Can you sort of share the rationale for that?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Ranking Member. I'm happy to do that. Keep in mind, right now, we have a provision in existing law right now that requires the plans make an offer to contract with all of our essential providers. So that requirement is in place right now. What we're in right now is the law as it exists requires ACA to serve basically as a referee of contract negotiations between the plans and the providers. Determine if the plans and providers can't reach a mutually acceptable rate structure, ACA then, as the agent, the regulator, is charged with determining whether or not the negotiations are happening in good faith. And if they're not happening in good faith, or if ACA determines they're not happening in good faith, then initiate proceedings through the administrative law process to go about the process of potentially removing the supplemental payments from the hospitals if they're deemed not to be negotiating in good faith. Quite frankly, I think that puts ACA in an untenable position. That's Agency for Healthcare Administration, not for the Agency for Healthcare Dispute Resolution. And so what we're trying to do is get them out of the business of picking winners and losers and saying, yes, this is good faith, or no, this is not good faith. Quite frankly, they're not equipped to do that, and it's not fair to ask them to do that. So what we're trying to do with this process is create objective standards for ACA to look at and determining, as is the case, as is law right now, that the supplemental payment plans are linked to the offer to contract. We're trying to get that out of the picture and say either have the contract or you don't. If you do, here's the cost benefit analysis for every party in determining that. We're also looking at network adequacy on the other side of it. So we're trying to buttress and improve the requirements for network adequacy on the plan's perspective. So by trying to have increased network adequacy requirements on one side, and objective standards on the supplemental payment language, we're trying to create a market incentive for everybody to come to the table and provide the best value.
All of you recognize.
Yes, and thank you for that. And I know that there are penalties if they do not contract, which I think are really outrageous, to be honest with you. Are there penalties, on the other side, let's just say, that particular plan chooses not to contract with that hospital due to, maybe one is in the hospital's in Miami and that plan is dealing with folks over in North Florida. If that contract is not done, are there penalties to that healthcare plan if they do not contract with that hospital? And then also, what does the hospital do, and how does that, if that medical plan does not contract with them or chooses to discontinue that contract, what is the hospital to do to, again, save them from not receiving this penalty?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
The answer to your first question is yes, but it's not as explicit as it would be on the other side. So yes, there are absolute network adequacy requirements that the plans are required to have in order to be consistent, in order to continue to be a participating plan under the procurement process. And there's also potential liquidated damages that come if they don't meet their benchmarks. So the answer to that question is yes. I think the question is the balance right? You know, so there's no question. I think everyone agrees that the plans obviously 100% of their funds come from having contracts with the hospital providers. So they have a market incentive to get in there and negotiate the best rate possible with these providers, with the essential providers. On the flip side, what we're trying to make sure is that both sides have an equal motivation to come to the table and negotiate and get a contract. Because ultimately, again, we said it before, it's about the patient, right? Providing the highest quality care at the lowest possible price for the patient. And while the hospitals and the plans certainly have their own business, you know, decisions to go into these negotiations, the one who loses if you don't have a contract is the patient. So that's what we're trying to focus on.
Follow up?
Yes.
You're right.
A follow up. And I'm trying to figure out what specifically is in place to make sure everyone comes to the table in good faith. I mean, it seems as though you're sort of strong-arming one, but then could possibly not get into a good contract that is conducive. I know we have seen here within the legislature, we have shunned upon folks who enter into bad contracts. And so what do we have in place? And I understand you mentioned, you know, you don't want ACA to be the mediator in this, but who is the mediator and where do we, what are we doing to make sure that everyone does right by the organizations, the state, but more importantly, the patient?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
I think the answer to your question is what we're trying to do is just this. Right now, the current system we have in place, to my mind, does not sufficiently incentivize both the plans and the providers to come to the table as quickly as possible and get something worked out, get a contract worked out. And the current process simply does not do that. And so the only other, we have really three different options if we want to look at this. The first option is we just keep it as it is in the status quo, which from my mind is just not, it's not an acceptable option. Option number two is we go look at this process right now. We look at, okay, what are some different financial incentives for both plans and the providers to incentivize them both to come to the table with the understanding that if they don't have an agreement, both run the risk of losing something that they don't want to lose. I think that's what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. Option number three is just get out of the business altogether and just say, you know, supplemental payments, you know, you either you have a contract with Medicaid, great. If you don't, that's, you know, not our problem. And so those are the three different options, get out of that altogether. I think from my perspective, I think option number three is just, again, ultimately that if you look at it from the patient perspective, are we doing everything we can to provide, to make sure that the Medicaid patients who are part of this program have access to high-quality care for the essential providers. And we're talking about essential providers who we deem to be so essential that we supplement or authorize supplementing their budgets with substantial amounts of money as reflected in the staff report. So it's a policy decision. From our standpoint, we are coming from the standpoint of what are we doing? Are we doing everything possible to ensure that those folks who are the enrollees, the patients who are receiving Medicaid, have access to these essential providers. And as best we can determine, this is, allows us the best option to make sure that happens.
Follow up, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of my last questions deal with the dental carve-in. Mm-hmm. I'm, again, just trying to get the rationale for carving them out. We've seen sort of an increase with just the data that's been provided in the analysis, but then there becomes a carve, and we're not where we need to be honest. But then we see a carve-in, just, you know, wanting to get the rationale of that. I know, and it seems to be where, you know, we were just in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so why now, when we've had folks that have not gone to their appointments, we've seen an influx of patients, I'm still trying to get a dentist appointment, you know, myself. But why now have a carve-in, you know, at a time, you know, those dentist appointments are very critical and access to quality care is.
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. The answer to your question right now is because we're forced to make this decision. With the current contract term expiring and the procurement getting set to go out, we have to make a choice one way or the other. It's like, you know, like my mom said long ago, sometimes not making a choice is making a choice, right? So the decision, if we make a decision to stay at the status quo, that in of itself is a choice. So we have to make a decision one way or the other as to whether or not we are going to reintegrate dental into the comprehensive managed care model or leave it carved out. It's a policy decision we have to make one way or the other, and that's forced upon us by the deadlines and the expiring contract provision. So hopefully that makes sense from a timing standpoint of why now, because we have to. The second question is a policy decision, and that's one, you know, this legislature made a decision a number of years ago. We began comprehensive managed care. Dental was an integrated part of that process, and there are certainly policy benefits that come as a result of having one provider responsible for the totality of holistic care for the individual. Carving it out or integrating it, you can make a policy argument on both sides. I guess from our standpoint, I'll tell you from my perspective as the bill sponsor, I'm not making this recommendation to this committee based upon necessarily the data we've seen during COVID. To your point, we're still working through the effect that COVID has on our data collection, especially as it relates to elective procedures during the last 2 years. But we look at it from a standpoint of ultimately what's going to provide the most comprehensive care for our dental patients at the lowest possible cost to the taxpayer, especially in situations where you have the Medicaid population, a number of them with unique healthcare challenges that oftentimes require a high level of integration between, you know, the dentist in the chair and the folks at the ER and the hospitals. There's some synergy there that when you have a carve-out situation, oftentimes there's not necessarily an economic incentive for the right hand, the left hand to work together. So, while certainly I understand and had a number of meetings with the folks from the dental plans and the dentists themselves, no one wants to be bounced around, you know, are you in, are you out? And have to adjust your business models based upon, you know, every few years, you know, is it going to change? But while I certainly understand that, we have to look at it and say, okay, ultimately, what's the best policy? Is integrated, holistic managed care the best policy going forward? And we think it is, not just in dental, but in services of mental health and other areas where you have different sites of providers. Ultimately, you have to have one person or one entity that's captain of the ship for managed care to work, and that's what we're trying to accomplish here.
Of Representative Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. My questions are along the same lines as Ranking Democrat Brown's are. In terms of the responsibility to contract with all providers, mm-hmm. and ultimately the goal is that the patient is the entity that we're looking out for.
Yep.
If the plan is in Miami-Dade and the facility is in Pensacola, how does it actually help a person in Pensacola who's not going to be able to get to Miami to get care? And is that an additional burden on both the plans and the facilities in terms of negotiating something that they're never going to use?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question. So there's really a two parts to that question, okay? One has to do with the mandatory contract language. The other has to do with, do we have hospitals classified correctly as essential providers or not? Right now, we have a very broad definition of what constitutes essential providers. I'll tell you, in the conversations really that we're having with the various stakeholders, there's two issues. Number one, you know, to your point, does it make sense to have to contract with the hospital in Pensacola for the plan down in Miami? Well, as law as it currently states, we've determined that hospital in Pensacola is deemed to be an essential provider, a statewide essential provider. So the question then becomes, okay, do we have that hospital classified correctly? And that's some of the discussions we're having with some of the hospitals in general, which is, okay, does it make sense for all these facilities to be categorized as an essential statewide provider, or are they more accurately a regional essential provider? So we're having some of those discussions and getting feedback from them right now. I think they'll probably testify to that a little bit later on. So that's question one. So as we work through this process and the committee process, one of the things we're looking at is, do we have the right institution in the right bucket? And we're having some really good discussions with the hospitals about that right now. The second process, part of it goes to the requirement to contract. And again, I want to emphasize, right now as we sit here today, we have a requirement to contract, okay? There's a requirement to negotiate in good faith and ultimately come to a contract. And if you can't negotiate in good faith and reach a contract, we have an administrative procedure to ultimately, if it works its way through its course, hospitals run the risk of losing their supplemental payments. So we're taking that existing structure right now, and what we're doing is saying, taking ACCA out of the determination of having to make the act as a judge and jury and sometimes prosecutor in those situations, and saying, look, good faith, bad faith, regardless, you've got the parties, both the plans and the providers, you've got to work this out, because if you don't, the person who suffers is the patient. And so we're having discussions with all the stakeholders about, is that balance correct? We're working through that, and I appreciate all the feedback we've gotten in the last week or so since this is our first committee stop, and those are going to continue. But that's ultimately what we're trying to get to, because the current status quo, ultimately, in our position, we think it hurts patients.
Hello?
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you. This isn't the second committee stop?
This is number two, correct.
Okay. Is there something that changes in any type of status or reimbursement if a facility becomes non-essential? In terms of the conversation you and I were just having about, maybe are they in the right bucket if they're essential? Does a lot change if they become not essential?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you. There's a differentiation sometimes between children's hospitals and others. The answer is yes, but it would depend on the specific situation.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. In terms of the dental carve-in, does that change or does that have any kind of a chilling effect on providers participating? I know, as you mentioned, that the pandemic is not a good way of determining whether the carve out worked or not, and you're at this pivotal point where you have to make a decision. But was the argument originally to carve out because there were not enough dental providers who wanted to participate in? And if so, is putting them back in going to have that same chilling effect? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. In my conversations with the folks in all sides of this debate, I don't see whether you have a carved out dental plan or an integrative dental plan as being the issue that's going to be dispositive about whether or not dentists and their practices are going to want to participate in Medicaid or not. I think there's a number of things that affects, both in terms of just how the administration works, but ultimately from a dentist perspective, I don't want to speak for them. They have a number of issues related to the program and how it can work more effectively. I don't think that specifically is going to be determined by whether it's integrated or carved out.
Next, we have Representative Woodson. Representative Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep. Garrison, as well, for coming up with the bill. I had a question on the dental issue, but it's been asked already, and you provided some response, because we want more dentists to have access, you know, to provide services to people, because dental contribute to your overall health. But I'm not going to touch that one. My second question had to do with ACCA receiving less Achieve Saving rebate funds because of the plan donations and medical education. Now, for the 2020 year, the state had added $88.5 million to the general revenue fund, mm-hmm, to the Achieve Saving Rebate Fund. Mm-hmm. Now, this change to the Achieve Saving Rebate will have an impact on the general revenue collections because of the change. So how do we plan on addressing that? Because my issue, by having this impact on the general revenue fund collections, I don't want us to rob Peter to pay Paul, how do we plan on addressing that change?
Representative Woodson, would you care to rephrase that? It sounded a lot
like debate. How do we plan on addressing that change in revenue?
Thank you, Chair. I will say, given the billions of dollars that are at stake with this particular policy, the amount of money we're talking about and the workforce changes are pretty minimal. What we're trying to accomplish with this provision is to, again, incentivize, through the way we structure this procurement, incentivize the plans and everyone involved to invest in workforce development. We have this in place right now for physicians. This is an existing program, an existing basically offset or deduction that we have to train doctors at this point. But as we've seen this last 2 years, it's not just physicians that are needed. We desperately need CNAs. We desperately need RNs. We need all aspects of our healthcare workforce. And anything we can do to incentivize these folks to facilitate the training of these professionals, to my mind, is the top of the list. And I would say, from my perspective, it's one, I think, the most impactful, long-term impactful things we're going to ultimately do with this bill.
Representative Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with you. We having a shortage in the healthcare industry. We definitely need more healthcare workers. My issue is I want to make sure I have a guarantee from you that this money we would not take from those other services that we need to offset that the change that we're talking about, that impact that we're talking about in here. Even though, yes, I know we have a lot of money, so I want to know how, because we would have that change, I want to make sure that we are not, you know, touching any other services. They won't be impacted by the change in the collection of the general revenue fund.
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, there's nothing that would do that in this bill, and I think you've plenty of things to argue about in this bill. That's not one. So I think you're fine.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Representative C. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Garrison. I know that there's a lot in the bill, so bear with me as I try to go through some of it. Actually, I did want to follow up on some questions Representative Woodson had, because I agree with you that the incentive to continue to make sure that we are, you know, certainly graduating nurses and other healthcare workers to address the shortage we have is really important. But as it relates to how the MLR works, the medical loss ratio works, of course, the medical loss ratio is intended to raise the quality of care by requiring that a certain percentage of those taxpayer dollars be spent on direct care. So if we are counting towards that, the continuing education for nurses and things of that nature, which is important, doesn't that make these providers less accountable for the actual quality aspect of the healthcare that is really being addressed with the medical loss ratio as a policy?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. No, I don't believe so. As you know, and you just alluded to, the medical loss ratio is a ratio designed to determine the percentage of care that's being used for actual care with also a built-in percentage for administration that's necessary to accomplish that. And, of course, our chief savings rebate, we try to incentivize our providers to, through having a good medical loss ratio, saying, hey, the reason for that being, as you know, is that preventative care on the front end, ultimately, spend now, you save later in a weird kind of economic way here. So you want your medical loss ratio, if you're spending more on preventative care in the immediate term, it means long term, by making those investments on the front end, you're hopefully precluding some of the more expensive acute issues that come when you don't have that sort of preventative care on the front end. So we're trying to incentivize that. With the Achieve Savings Rebate, what we have in place is says that, okay, for the first, you know, for plans who make that profit, they keep 100% up to 5%. The next 5% is split 50-50 between the state, and beyond that, it all returns back to the state. by adjusting the medical loss ratio to include the workforce training aspect, what we're trying to do is incentivize them, quite frankly, in the same standpoint, to make those payment costs on the front end, where now they would be disincentivized to do it, and saying we're going to help that work towards your medical loss ratio. So ultimately, you will be financially incentivized in the long term by making these investments in the short term. Again, it's a market-based approach. We're trying to do whatever we can to increase the market incentive for these folks to spend additional money on that otherwise wouldn't be spending to develop workforce, and saying if you do this on the front end, you'll receive this benefit on the back end.
Representative C. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Avila. Thank you, Representative Garrison, for the answer. Chair Avila and committee staff knows that I'm a very big proponent of medical loss ratios in healthcare. So, you know, I just wanted to kind of have this dialogue to address my concern that by incentivizing the continuing education of nurses through MLR, that we're not inadvertently creating less accountability for the providing of the quality healthcare. Now, on that, I guess on that line of the medical loss ratio, I want to find out how this particularly impacts dental care, because my understanding is that when the agency carved dental into medical for the first time in 2014, that they implemented a medical loss ratio only really for the medical services. So in this bill, if we're going to carve dental back in, will there still be a medical loss ratio specifically for dental services?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. To the best of my knowledge, and again, I preserve the right to be wrong. To the best of my knowledge, no. You have a comprehensive care is just that. So if you reintegrate dental into the managed care portfolio, so to speak, it certainly would be subject to all the MLR ratios that would apply, but there would not be a standalone provision for dental as opposed to being carved out.
Representative C. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the response. There was also a discussion earlier about potentially incentivizing dental providers to continue withdrawing from Medicaid. Some of this has to do with lack of good reimbursement, because we see that as being a trend. Some of them don't want to provide because of the lack of reimbursement. So is the agency under your bill proposing to increase the amount of funding and the reimbursement for dental care if they're going to be carved back in?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
I would say reimbursements from participating dentists is an issue. You hear it when you talk to dental providers all the time. I can't speak to that. I just don't know the answer to your question. This particular bill deals simply with the procurement process and doesn't address the issue of reimbursement. But you're right in that that's certainly an issue, a challenge, whether you're integrated or carved out. Obviously, you know, having a reimbursement rate that get dentists willing to participate is an issue we have to address.
Representative C. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Avila, also for the indulgence. This is an important conversation. It sounds like then we're not going to increase the reimbursement rate if we're carving dental back in. My related question is, how then are we measuring the success of the program now that we're going to be carving them in with everyone else? Specifically the dental program, how do we measure that success there?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Ultimately, the way we try to measure success in any sort of environment, which is, you know, look at the data. Whether it's integrated or carved out, we're going to keep track of the data and find out whether or not, you know, we're meeting our goals or not. That's we have that now, we're going to have that regardless. So, you know, from my perspective, whether we integrate or whether we carve out, a responsibility that we have as taxpayers and the legislature is to make sure, you know, the whole point of doing this exercise is to make sure that our Medicaid recipients are getting access to dental care, period, both in terms of preventative care on the front end and then when necessary to make sure when you have complicated cases that they receive that care. So We're going to require, I think absolutely, whether it's integrated or carved out, we have to do a very good job and encourage ACA through whatever levers we have to make sure whether it's dental care, mental health, any sort of care, that we're getting the data to make informed decisions, not just during this procurement, but as we go forward.
One final follow-up, Mr. Chair, please.
Representative C. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rep. Garrison. Shifting gears really quick, there was another part of the bill that stood out to me. Let's see, lines, I think it's 265 to 272. So it talked about, well, it looks like what the lines in the bill do is that they get rid of a requirement that before we submit a federal waiver application, that we no longer have to provide the public notice and opportunity for public comment and include that feedback in the waiver application to the federal government. Folks that know me also know that I'm a huge fan of public meetings and public records too. So I guess my question is why does your bill eliminate the requirement for public notice and comment regarding a change to the Medicaid program?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
The short answer is this: that specific language, I don't know off the top of my head. I will circle back with you on it. Going through these sorts of things, what we're trying to, a lot of this language has to do is somewhat obsolete when we were transitioning from the managed care model to a fee-for-service model to a managed care model. That may be one of those areas, but I'll double-check on that and follow up with you.
Thank you, Rob Garrison.
Ranking Member Brown, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have one quick question relating to just the access for cancer treatment. I know it mentioned that we were required to go into contract, or providers were required to go into contract with the Moffitt and Sylvester in Miami. Wanted to know who were the ones we contracted with prior to Moffitt and Sylvester within this contract. Were there others we contracted with before, or it's just been sort of the same ones?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative, I think I understand your question to be saying, are there cancer specialty hospitals that are deemed to be essential providers, statewide essential providers under current law? And the answer to that question is no. There is not. So as we sit here right now, both of those facilities have received, I mean, there's a technical term for it, but basically it's premier status in the healthcare world for the work they do on cancer treatments. Right now, despite that premier status, they are not deemed to be statewide essential providers. And to my mind, I think that's an oversight we're trying to address with this bill.
Members, further questions? Further questions? One last one. Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. Thank you, Rep. Garrison, again, for answering our questions. My last question also has to do with the guardian ad litem children who were in the child welfare, who have been they're allowing them to select the child welfare specialty plan as opposed to the MMA plan. And the fiscal impact is estimated to be at $12.2 million on that one. Again, what are the provisions? What do we have in place to address that? Because if there's going to be another fiscal impact in that area as well. So what's the plan for that?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
The plan is we pay for it. I mean, these young men and women, these kids now growing into adulthood, have been through an awful lot. And to my mind, we have specialty plans that exist to address the specific needs with coming through the foster care system. And when you have, quite frankly, what I think is a loophole right now to where you have folks, I mean, Representative Brown, I know, has done a tremendous amount of work in this area. So we're building on her good work as part of this process to ensure that these young men and women who are not in the foster care system per se, but are as part of the guardianship process, but still have the unique challenges that come as a result of really that trauma. We want to make sure they are eligible for the specialty Medicaid program that we have designed for those folks. And quite frankly, if it costs us a little extra money, then so be it.
just don't want this to.
I don't say that cavalierly, but I understand.
You know what my follow-up right. was going to be, but I'm done.
You could definitely save that for debate.
I can talk to her. Yeah, we can talk to later. All right, thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Woodson. Members, further questions? Seeing no further questions, I believe we have an amendment. Members, right now, staff is passing out the amendment. And this amendment is going to be presented by Representative Duran. Representative Duran, you're recognized to present your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, wanted to introduce this amendment. This is the second time I have seen this bill in front of me. And while the representative was kind of elaborating on what this his bill proposes to do, several times you heard him say it helps to instill competition that helps bring down costs and increase quality, and in the spirit of ensuring competition. I wanted to introduce this amendment that would remove that language that requires the essential providers to contract with the plan payers. I think what we're introducing here essentially brings us back a couple of years to where we allow two sophisticated entities to enter into negotiations, one being a payer who will provide the payments of the Medicaid program to those providers, our hospital systems, who have gone through the hoops and barriers to require to get that status in Medicaid, to get in the form to be able to be reimbursed. What it does is it removes us, moves government from allowing that conversation to happen, and that's really here to help foster competition. That's the amendment.
Having explained the amendment, members, we're now in questions on the amendment. Representative Tribolsi. Vice Chair Tribolsi, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Avila. Rep. Garrison, is this a friendly amendment?
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
At this time, no, it is not.
It is, however, from a friendly member.
Very friendly member. One of my favorite members, but not a friendly amendment.
Further questions on the amendment, members? Further questions? Seeing no further questions on the amendment, we're now in public testimony on the amendment. Seeing no public testimony on the amendment, members, we're now in debate on the amendment. Seeing no debate on the amendment, Representative Duran, you're recognized to close on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I appreciate your willingness to allow me to present this and put this in front of you, an idea that I hope could help us spur some continued conversation. A couple of things, members, and I don't want to go too long and belabor too long on this issue, but I've been here for now this is my sixth session. I've been on the Appropriations Committee in Healthcare Appropriations. I've had the opportunity to be and serve on this committee for that many years. This is no easy committee to serve on. It is complex, and it will be, and I'm still befuddled even this year as I continue to move on into my last year. But I will say this, that I have seen us engage on this issue for the last several years, and we are the Appropriations Committee, so this bill does impact the work that we do, and this provision does though as well. When we talk about supplemental payments, if you looked at the staff analysis on page 16, we're talking about $5.48 billion that is what we're talking about. This is no small chunk of change. It is critical and important to the work that these essential providers do in our community. And I'm not coming in here as somebody who is gaming this for any personal reasons. Look, I served on the board of the Public Health Trust down where I am, the largest hospital system here in the state of Florida. And it was an absolute honor to be able to do so. I did it because when several years before that, my daughter was 2 years old, she was at the happiest place in the world in Disney World. and we come back, she has pneumonia. We're in the hospital, and I watched these people, as she took her last breath, take over and help keep her alive. And so I saw the power of that public health system and what it does. And it's not just for people like me who have means and opportunity. It is for everyone. They treat you the same, no matter what your socioeconomic situation is. And that really is what we're looking at here. If you think about what we talked about last week, we are talking about reimbursement cuts in the Medicaid and the $200+ million that impact those healthcare systems. We are talking about critical care fund that's going away. And so really what I'm hoping we can try to do is allow our public health systems, which are sophisticated entities unto themselves, the ability to negotiate at its best with the payers. And I'm not going against any payers in any way, shape, or form. But to say that we need to give them one hand up in this negotiation would be, to me, I have a bridge in Brooklyn, I can tell you, if you believe that's the case, that we need to do that here. This is about allowing competition to foster and maintain itself. This is about taking into account the reality of what we are doing on the financial side with building our budget. And it's taking ourselves out of it. If you looked at the stuff that AHCA dropped off in our offices today, nowhere in there did they ask you for this. I haven't heard any payers come and ask for this either. But what this really truly does is kind of put us in a place where we were before. I have not heard of any network adequacy issues that we need to take on right now. If it was, then it'd be compelling enough for us to go into this matter. But I think right now, for the interests of this legislation, which has great, important legislation that we need to move forward with, but this aspect here is troubling. And one of the things that I'll close with this, we have to stop combining hospital systems and thinking of them all as the same. Our private healthcare system, our public health hospitals, our nonprofit hospitals are not the same. They don't have the same net operating margins. They don't operate in the same way. This has been particularly enduring last 2-3 years with respect to COVID in the pandemic and how they've had to tap dance through these things. Yes, federal funding has come in, but it has certainly been there to kind of keep them moving forward. I don't think this is about how much bigger the yacht is going to be by some of these folks. These are complex, important entities in our community, and we need to keep that in mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Having closed on the amendment, all those in favor of the adoption of the amendment say yay.
Yay.
All opposed say no.
No.
No. So the amendment fails. Members, we're back on the bill. Do we have public testimony on the bill? We do. First, we have with the Florida Hospital Association, David Micah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David Micah, on behalf of the Florida Hospital Association, our more than 200 members across the state. First off, I want to be clear about a couple things. I want to thank Chair Garrison or Rep Garrison for his hard work on this bill. He's been open to us and let us have those conversations. And the focus of our points as we look at this comes to that partnership. And I want to be very clear about one thing. Managed care is a vital piece of this state's work and where we get to providing service for more than 5 million now vulnerable Floridians. As we look at those and that partnership is created, this procurement has given us a wonderful opportunity to kind of talk about those outcomes and those ways that we can talk through improving those outcomes and build that out and the work AHCA has to do in that process. I do want to focus on that essential provider language as we see fit. And Rep Garrison has said he'd work with us on that piece, and we'll continue to do that. Won't belabor the points, but I think Rep Duran and Rep Brown have kind of highlighted some of those for the committee. And so, unfortunately, right now, in opposition to the bill, but committed to keep working on it as this moves through the process. Thank you.
Justin Senior with the Safety Net Hospital Alliance. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Justin Senior. I'm the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance. We're 14 systems around the state, and the majority of our systems are, in fact, identified as essential providers under this language. And I have to say that this bill, 7047, there is a lot of really good stuff in this bill. And I have to say, in a former life, I was the Medicaid director of the state of Florida, as well as the secretary of the Agency for Healthcare Administration. And there are a lot of elements in this bill that I would really like to see carried forward and passed into law. Our objection, as being identified as essential providers, is very specific, and it is to the mandatory contracting language. Ultimately, the issues that we have been raised by committee members, and it has to do with that the provider list, the essential provider, the definition, is right now too broad, and it mandates relationships that don't make any sense. Providers in Pensacola being mandated to be under contract with plans in Miami, primary care providers in the Panhandle being mandated to be under contract with plans in Palm Beach, things like that. Also, the punishments are uneven. Ultimately, it's a really draconian punishment on one side, on the hospitals and on the providers identified as essential. And the punishments are actually tied to things like the low-income pool, which has nothing to do with Medicaid. It has to do with uninsured families that don't have Medicaid. It's also tied to graduate medical education, which is physician workforce training. Literally, if one hospital in Miami doesn't have a contract with a health plan in the Panhandle, it could jeopardize all of the state's or the bulk of the state's graduate medical education funding, a significant portion of it, and almost all of its uninsured, uncompensated care funding. So ultimately, we think that the punishments need to become less draconian. They also need to be even. There needs to be some evenness, so that both the health plan and the essential provider, an updated essential provider list, could potentially, that would be workable. We have been working with Representative Garrison. He's been very generous with his time. We are very optimistic, and I think we've had really productive conversations with him about ways to make this language a little bit more palatable. But ultimately, that is our interest in the bill, and we're committed to trying to find a way forward and look forward to working with them. But at this point, we do have to be in opposition to it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We have Joanne Hart with the Florida Dental Association. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Avila, Vice Chair Tribolsi, Ranking Member Brown, and committee members. My name is Joanne Hart, Chief Legislative Officer for the Florida Dental Association, and I'm here today to speak in opposition to Section 8 of House Bill 7047. First, I'd like to start by thanking Representative Garrison. He's been more than willing to sit down with us and go over all of our concerns with that section of the bill, and he has really tried to understand the nuances and challenges we foresee with this change. I want to direct your attention to Section 8, page 24, line 593. It adds dental service as a minimum benefit that must be offered by the medical plans. And since medical plans don't offer dental services, they would be subcontracting with the same dental managed care plans who contract right now directly with AHCA. So just to give you an example, AHCA right now contracts with 3 dental managed care plans. Under the scenario of this bill, AHCA would contract with a number of medical plans and be required to offer dental services. But since they don't, they will subcontract with those same dental managed care plans. And the problems that we saw that happened in 2014 is when those dental managed care plans may have had a request to do a little bit something different. I think one example was right around the beginning of school, they wanted to do some incentive promotions to get kids to go to see their dentist before they started school. And instead of them being able to talk to AHCA, they had to send those requests and questions and concerns to the medical plans that they had contracted with, and then have those medical plans then talk to AHCA. And then the reverse of that information had the same process. So it created an administrative barrier. It slowed down the process. And it was disruptive to our participating dentists and could potentially impact patient care. And the worst part about this that we don't want to see is that it will create a disincentive for dentists to participate. Now let's go to page 26, starting at line 630. This whole section that is being deleted from statute is where AHCA was authorized by the legislation that passed in 2016 to separate dental out of medical. But language states that it could stop this carve-out in 2017, but it didn't do so. So by 2019, dental was contracted out separately. So let's go to page 27, line 658. It directs that ACA shall include in the contracts for dental a medical loss ratio, which means that 85% of funds allocated for dental in the Medicaid program goes towards direct care, and no more than 15% can go towards administrative costs. So the question is, and I think it was asked earlier, where is the provision for a medical loss ratio for dental care when dental is carved into medical? And let's not forget to talk about the most important part of this program, and that's funding. Dental has not been adequately funded in the Medicaid program for years. We have been moving and shifting dental around, reassigning who should manage the contracts without any additional funding. If the agency really wants to prioritize the number of recipients receiving dental care, then I believe funding plays a huge part in that discussion. To my knowledge, there is no recommendation to increase funding allocated to dental care. So we are operating on 20 plus years of old fees and expect for there to be a significant change in access, and that doesn't make sense. In 2019, the legislature passed into law the Dental Student Loan Repayment Program. This would incentivize dentists to become Medicaid providers. At this time, there is no funding in the budget for this. So we hope that the House would take a look at the Senate budget, which does allocate $1.7 million for this program to help incentivize more dentists to participate in the program. And I want to end with urging you to keep dental separate, allow for the provider networks to be built up, create some incentives to get dentists to participate. Don't dismantle this by adding another administrative change that ends in unnecessary administrative layers that could jeopardize access to dental care. And I would like to leave with inviting everyone on this committee to attend the Florida Mission of Mercy event, where you will be able to see more than over hundreds of dentists, dental hygienists, and dental labs provide free dental care to individuals who need it the most. And that event is going to be here in Tallahassee. It's scheduled for March 11th and 12th. I know 11th is the last day of session, so you'll be busy. But if you take a moment to come by the Civic Center on Saturday, I think you'll see what you do here and how it impacts the actual recipients and patients. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Oh, we have a question for you. Representative C. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hart, for providing us some of this information. I guess I just want to clarify what one of the concerns was, because when Rep. Garrison presented the bill, I was asking about the reimbursement rate for Medicaid, that is potentially a factor in why we don't have enough dental providers. Can you speak more to the need for a reimbursement rate and how this bill, I don't know what the reimbursement rate is right now for dental providers compared to Medicaid managed care, but can you speak to that and the impact of the bill there specifically?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Right now, the reimbursement rates for dental care are probably ranging pretty low compared to other states. What the exact amount is, we typically say it's about 25 cents on the dollar. I just actually got some information from the American Dental Association looking at the rates compared to other states. And again, we are probably pretty low compared to other states like Texas and California with their rates. So the fact that the reimbursement rates are low, the fact that if we carve dental in, it creates administrative barriers that they now have to go through medical plans, that does become a disincentive for dentists to participate. And that's something that we don't want to see, because we understand the focus of this should be on the patients and on increasing access. And as I mentioned, with our program, the Dental Student Loan Program, it actually targets rural and underserved areas. So they're not going into metropolitan areas and setting up. They're actually working in county health departments and community health centers. So if we can figure out how to incentivize dentists to participate, that's what we want to do.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Members, we now have Audrey Brown with the Florida Association of Health Plans. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a privilege to be here before you today to talk about this good bill. We do support the spirit of this bill when we thank the sponsor, Representative Garrison, for his hard work as well as the hard work of the staff that has thoughtfully and carefully obviously put this together in front of you. And we believe this to be sort of an evolution of the procurement process. I came from the insurance commissioner's office. I didn't have the Medicaid-heavy background when I took over this position in 2013, but I did get to work for state leaders who believed in big, hairy, audacious goals. And one of those goals was to take pilot programs, to look at Medicaid, to take parts of the state and see and test what would happen if the state moved from the fee-for-service model, which was kind of a pay-and-chase, you know, fee-for-service model where the state owned that piece, and see what would happen if you put the entire continuum of services for Medicaid, our most vulnerable, under a coordinated, comprehensive system of care and include all services. And in some of those reform counties, it did include dental, and the dental services or dental providers subcontracted during that period. And so those reform counties, and I'll take you back a little bit because I have the history, I remember, because again, I started this position with the association as the president and CEO in 2013. We went right into the first year of the new Medicaid managed care program. But prior to that, what the legislature found in those reform counties, there was a 14% higher dental care provided in terms of getting that preventive visit done, 14% higher than in non-reform counties where dental was carved out. So I speak to that just to give you a little bit of history. And I think that the other part of the rationale for having dental as part of the overall services provided by the health plans is the fact that the health plan is accountable to the state. We are under contract with the state to provide specific services. Dental, we believe, is incredibly important. Oral health is incredibly important to holistic overall health. We value our relationships with our dentists and all of our providers, our hospitals, our doctors, our nurses. We value all of those. Those are the very people doing the work. We are the ones tasked with pulling all of that together, care coordinating, case managing, and especially for vulnerable population, like what the folks we have in Medicaid. We need to make sure we wrap our arms around that person and understand all the needs and be able to facilitate all of these different services. Dental being carved out was very difficult, and it was a three-year process and a lot of debate. And frankly, the dental plans that we used to subcontract with are still part of our association and work with the plans as associate members. But at that time, when this was carved out, we actually were achieving higher quality scores than ever before, year over year, working with our dental plan partners as our subcontractors. Ultimate accountability on the health plans, but our subcontractors, the very dental plans we're talking about right now, they were our partners. Currently, we are still responsible for providing transportation to dental visits. The health plans are, not the dental plans. And that makes it a little bit difficult in terms of coordination of services. It makes so much sense to me as you consider the overall bill that what we saw through the reform time period in the counties was that we had more services provided and higher level of service provided. And that once dental was carved in as part of the comprehensive coordinated model that you have today, that we saw an incredible continuous increase in quality scores year over year with that carved in model. And I know what the scores look like now, and I know that there are concerns about the scores, but also that we have gone through a pandemic period. But what I can give you is the history. And the history shows that we were one of the lowest states performing in dental services and Medicaid in this country. And we over-doubled it in the first year we had comprehensive Medicaid managed care with dental carved in. So I'll leave you with that. I do want to just also point out just a couple of things. I don't view a disruption, as I think we've heard the disruption of services, should you all make the policy decision to move dental back in, because we're talking about an entire procurement that must be undertaken. we will have new plans. We may have incumbent plans, but we don't know what that's going to look like. So there will be a somewhat of a disruption for all Medicaid recipients because this would happen after a re-procurement. But I submit to you that the state has very thoughtfully had have in place things like continuity of care provisions. So the vulnerable Medicaid population has time to ramp up and they have time to get comfortable with the new procurement once that's implemented. And however you all decide to do that and whatever you decide to do with the provisions of the bill, I wanted to just share with you all that we do support this bill on the whole because I think it was done in a way that was very thoughtful and is really an evolution of what we've seen through both procurements through the years. I do know I have members of my own association who probably don't like specific pieces. So I can't represent those specific pieces. But what I'm saying to you is that we believe that legislation and policymakers made the wise decision, and it was a fiscal decision as well, looking at the growth of our state, the ever-aging population we have to take care of, and the fact that fee-for-service and your social services estimating conference just showed this last report. There are still 1 million people in fee-for-service in Florida. Little known fact, I guess. But there are 5 million in Medicaid, but 4 are in managed care. Those 1 million people cost almost over twice as much to care for than under the managed care model of comprehensive care, where we, as the accountable partners with the state, must be the ones to hold costs down, provide comprehensive services, and where we don't have a contract. If we don't have a contract with a cancer hospital, we need to get our member, our patient to that hospital, we will do one-off case agreements, so that no one's missing out on the service. They are going to get the service they need. That's part of it. And don't forget the transportation part. So again, if we have a person in Miami-Dade who must go to a hospital because of something specific that they need in another part of the state, transportation is part of that coordinated, comprehensive model that you and your predecessors embraced. And I submit to you that we are good taxpayer stewards. We believe in this program, obviously. We want to see it continue to flourish and work with you and be your partners. And I'm always here as a resource. I know I haven't got to meet all of you personally, but I was here for the implementation of this, and I really think that the state has embraced a program that is something for forward-thinking so that we can manage the budget, but also take care and give the best quality care to our most vulnerable residents. And I thank the providers, all of them, including our dentists and everybody else in this room, for working with us, embracing us, and we will work with them and continue to work with you. And so thank you again, Chair Gerson.
Thank you, members. We're now going to go to Cody Farrell with the Agency for Healthcare Administration. You are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I thought I'd do is just let's guide my comments based on some of the questions that we received. So I was going to start, obviously, with dental. So I think it's important to note, kind of building on what you've heard for the proponents of that policy, I would reiterate that the goal of this is to ensure the highest quality care is delivered to individuals that are within the comprehensive Medicaid program. I think the question about COVID is a question that can be asked, but I think the question that you must ask yourself is, we know that the integrated model works. We know that the integrated model increased outcomes exponentially. And so the question is, when you're making this decision, obviously it's not going to come into effect tomorrow, but it's going to be for that coverage period between 2025 and 2030. So we're making a decision. I know some folks would prefer us not to have the debate, but we're thankful, especially to this chamber, for having the debate, because we should be focused every managed care procurement cycle of making sure that we're looking and seeing what more can be done to serve our most vulnerable, to make sure they have the highest outcomes. I'd also mention something that hasn't been mentioned today, but one of the best reasons that you should reintegrate dental care is due to the fact that dental plans, obviously, yes, you heard the argument that they have their own networks today, they have providers today, et cetera.
Well, I would argue that managed care plans, some of them actually have their own dental plan, for one. But for two, managed care plans have pre-established relationships with other types of medical specialists, such as hospitalists, hospital dentists, anesthesiologists. All of that matters to that continuum of care for someone on Medicaid, especially for that population that may require sedation dentistry. I would also note that when you hear about reimbursement rates, I think it's important to note that managed care plans are required to meet network adequacy. And so they're going to pay what's required to get dentists within their network. I'd also argue that the dental plans today have that ability. When you hear from the, you know, the dental entities that are out there, you know, they're going to talk to you about the MLR, as Representative Smith mentioned. I would note two things. One is, obviously, medical loss ratio matters. We totally agree. What we would say is, in terms of the returns they've made to the state, you know, that's undelivered care since COVID. Obviously, we've seen them return money to the state at a much higher rate than we'd probably love, right? Because we want to make sure folks are getting the care. But at the end of the day, the managed care plan in an integrated model would still be contractually obligated to return any funds to the state for care that's not delivered. Managed care plans, just like dental plans in the integrated model, have you know, federal and state quality requirements to ensure that care is being delivered. You know, I find it very interesting that the Dental Association would go as far to say that they had issues with the Dental Performance Improvement Strategy in Line 617. I would tell you that the point there is we are recognizing the connection of dental health to overall health. And so I find that odd that regardless of a carve-in or carve-out structure, I think that language is something that needs to be a part of the conversation, because clearly putting something in statute in this case may help the agency in managing those contracts as well. Moving on to Representative Brown, you had a question about cancer treatment. And so I wanted to reiterate that, yes, folks on Medicaid today do have access to cancer treatment. However, Florida's home to two, you know, federally qualified comprehensive cancer centers. My own father actually went to one in Alabama for about 4 years when I was growing up. This is a very different model than you see at other types of facilities that offer cancer treatment. They also get an additional amount of federal funding through the Medicaid reimbursement process, specifically for Medicaid, to ensure that they're getting, you know, their full reimbursement to cover their cost. And so for us, it's that someone on Medicaid should have the same quality of care and the same access that my own father has. And so we think that this provision is important to the discussion. I would say I'm not going to get into the overall essential provider discussion on other parts of the bill, but specifically when you talk about comprehensive cancer coverage, you know, our secretary and I were talking this morning, we want to make sure that folks on Medicaid are treated no differently than our own loved ones. And this is something that plans and those entities have not been able to come to agreement on, and we want to make that required. Moving back towards, talking about reimbursement rates, Representative Smith, I would just reiterate what I already mentioned, that the reimbursement rate itself, I get that discussion, but at the end of the day, dental plans are getting paid enough today that they agreed to negotiated benefits to offer expanded benefits at no cost to the state. And so if they're going to argue the reimbursement rate, they are offering additional benefits that we also were able to negotiate in the managed care structure, the fully integrated structure, to provide additional services to the adult population at no cost to the state. So it's interesting that I don't disagree that that obviously is part of the discussion, but it's that they already are offering more than they're necessarily leading on. And so it's an interesting discussion about the reimbursement rates. Last thing I would mention is just in general, the point of this bill is to make sure that we are making the right decisions for this group of people as we move on to our next procurement cycle. We appreciate the discussion. We're willing to continue working with all parties on the bill, and we appreciate your support.
Representative C. Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the thorough testimony. I wanted to ask about a specific issue because I think either we've never had one or it's just been so long that it feels like we've never had one. Is there going to be a plan as part of this change if we carve dental back in to actually have a state Medicaid dental director that would be responsible for overseeing the program, reviewing the program, dealing and managing issues related to contracts Is that at all part of the vision of ACA in implementing this change?
Mr. Chairman?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative Smith. I would say that, you know, actually in April, ACA hired our first ever chief medical officer. So Secretary Marstiller came in and hired Dr. Chris Kogel. He is not a dentist by trade, but he's very, he works within the UF Health Network, and he's very aware of those concerns. And so I would say as we're building our procurement, we're actually going to be, you know, leaning on him as our chief medical officer to really dive into issues such as that. You know, I can get back to you specifically on a dentist, but I would say in general, we took the first step in even having a physician on our team.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the response. You know, I would certainly see that as an important goal for us to be able to have a state Medicaid dental director to be able to oversee the plan. I wanted to kind of jump over to the medical loss ratio aspect because I just need help in clarifying whether there's any concern. If we are possibly diluting the effectiveness of a medical loss ratio standard by including some of these changes to how it's calculated as it relates to undergraduate and graduate student nursing education positions, student positions in any degree or technical program deemed to be a shortage by ACA, if we're carving dental back in, and that doesn't necessarily specifically apply to them. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to my concern that including it will dilute MLR possibly overall, including for providers who are not dental?
Mr. Chairman,
I would probably echo, you know, the representative's comments on, you know, this is something where we should be focused on, you know, the money that would be utilized in this case is care that is not delivered. We have robust requirements of our managed care plans that they must meet certain metrics before they, you know, they'd be assessed a liquidated damage. With that specific language, we heard from the legislature loud and clear that you're wanting a focus on healthcare workforce. Obviously, that language A does provide the agency discretion to add additional types of medical providers. So one could argue you could add other providers such as dentists. But I would say that in general, from my perspective, they're still contractually obligated to meet an MLR and ASR. In this case, it's just allowing them to invest a portion of what would be returned to the state. It's not like it's going to go to line their pockets. It's got to be used to invest in the overall quality of care of Floridians.
Further questions? Seeing no further questions.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, members, that concludes public testimony. We're now in debate on the bill. We're now in debate. In debate. Is there a debate? Ranking Member Brown, you're recognized. In debate. Yes, on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Garrison, for bringing this somewhat good bill forward. Today, I wanted to just, you know, put it on the record that just as it stands, like I said, there are some good things in it, but I just can't support it. To me, it's a bad policy decision. And I just feel it's just not real good business for pretty much everyone involved. As I mentioned, there are some great things in this bill, including, you know, things that I've worked on last year and this year relating to our foster children. I'm definitely grateful to see the increased access in phenomenal care of cancer treatment. I'm not sure where Cody is, but you know, my question there was just more for understanding, not as a attack. But I think we actually, while we're on that conversation, I think we should be doing more on the front end versus cancer treatment. And what I mean by that is even including into these plans screenings. Right now, women are only able to receive one of the diagnostic screenings to find out whether or not they have cancer, and I think it's critical, again, and it saves us money on the front end by including additional diagnostic testing when it comes to breast cancer, even including, again, reducing, and I know we're looking to do more within the step therapy place, but, again, reducing barriers with access to prescription drug that actually saves lives. But I'll go back to my thing. I think we honestly, with just this bill, some of the things we're doing moves us backward when it comes to the decisions made. Again, I personally feel it affects access to care. I think we have to provide incentives to our doctors who participate in our Medicaid plans. We have seen in years past, just again, not providing the access and helping some of, you know, bringing some of our doctors on board, especially within our dentist area. I think we have to do that. In my district, and I believe it's also statewide, those statistics are the number one reason why our students are missing school simply is because of, again, dental issues. And so we have to continue to move those numbers forward to the statistics and the numbers where we need to see them, not just doubling some horrible statistics that we've had in the past. Again, to me, unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I just feel we kind of are looking to put our hospitals on life support. We have to, the requirements we're putting in is just to me a little too much. And just again, what's at stake with their supplemental funding is something I just cannot support. I hope there's still more time to work on this bill. I would love to work with you, but you know, just based off of those concerns that I have, I'm gonna have to be down on the bill. But thank you so much for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Ranking Member Brown. We have Representative Woodson in debate. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep. Garrison, for bringing this bill forward. I know you have worked very hard on this bill, have you have always had. There are some great sections in this bill. However, there are some concerning ones to me as well. You have heard concerns from the providers, from advocates, and I have received some, you know, a lot of calls, a lot of emails as well from my constituents and as well from various entities as well. I hope you can take those concerns into consideration, and I know you can do that. I have worked with you on other bills, and you have always, you have an open door when it comes to that, and you are always willing to make changes. They need, the providers need to be fairly reimbursed when it comes to our doctors, our hospital, especially the Safety Net Hospital. I have seen firsthand how they work in my community. But also, we have to ensure that we have a healthcare system that works for everyone, in order for everyone, the underprivileged one, the unfortunate one, the vulnerable one, that they have full access to the continuum of care that we provide in our state. I hope you will continue to work with the parties to take this bill to where it needs to be, so it can benefit everyone, and I know that you can do that. So thank you.
Representative Snyder. Thank you, Representative Woodson. Representative Snyder, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this good bill forward. You know, it reminds me, I think a lot of what we're hearing today reminds me of the saying, nobody likes the way things are, and everybody hates change. And I think the easy thing to do, as you mentioned, would be to kick the can a little further down the road. But I know that's not your style, and just want to say we appreciate your leadership on this. And one of the comments that was made was, you know, what does ACA say about this bill? And you know, in looking through the things that jump out at me is ensure improved access to care, align with current operations, increase access to comprehensive cancer treatment, improve the procurement process, and investing in Florida's healthcare workforce. So, members, I urge you to vote up on the bill, and again, thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Snyder. Members, further debate. Representative C. Smith, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Garrison, for dealing with all of our questions. Long bill, complicated bill. As other members pointed out, there's some good stuff in here. I can't support the bill today as it's written because of some of the concerns that I have, which I want to flag for you first. I did have a question before about the public meeting and the public comment portion, and I just spoke with staff, and I appreciated the clarification that actually that just kind of brings us in compliance with what we're currently doing. So it looked like that was technical, so I think I'm okay with that part. The state-mandated contracts are problematic, especially with the what I would characterize as draconian punishments for especially our critical providers, our safety net hospitals, who are not able to meet that standard, even if they engage in good faith. You know, we're talking about LIP funding. We're talking about lots of critical supplemental funding that's on the line for our providers that do a lot to make sure that our most vulnerable Floridians get the care that they need. So huge concern there. And of course, I have major concerns about the carve-in for dental, particularly due to the fact that not only are we jerking them around, because we just carved them out, now we're carving them back in, and there's no consistency. But, you know, I also do have a question about actually having a state Medicaid dental director, because the person we have in the position now that was just hired as the CMO, chief medical officer, I mean, doesn't have knowledge, expertise, and background in dental. And I think that's really important, especially if we are going to proceed with carving them back in, that we have someone in that role. That's just something related that I wanted to flag for you, too. So I'll be down on the bill today. Thank you.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized in the debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep. Garrison. This is a heavy lift, I know. I know you have all the support you need to pass this bill. It would have probably earned my support had we adopted Rep. Duran's amendment, because that is a very big concern that I have, in addition to the dental carve-in, dental carve-out little bit of seesawing that we're doing. And I don't disagree at all with Rep. Snyder, who listed all of the great things that ACA wants to be able to do with this bill. And I support all of those things. It's just the method and the path and the policy decisions that we enact to get us there. And everyone that has debated has said that it's a work in progress, and I appreciate that. And everyone who has testified has said that your door is open, and I appreciate that as well. So I'm hopeful that we get where we need to go. And you've heard the concerns from all of the folks who are involved, including the policymakers here. And I hope that you will continue to work with everybody and get us to a place where we can all support exactly what you are saying that we're trying to do, and we do it in a way that we feel that it is in the best interest of the people of the state of Florida. So thank you so much.
Members, further debate? Further debate? Seeing no further debate, Sabrina? Oh, sorry, Representative Garrison, you're recognized to close on
message
your bill.
Message received, Mr. Chairman. In all seriousness, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for taking the time on today's committee schedule to go through this bill. I will tell you, I think it's a little biased, obviously, but how we're, as a House, and specifically at a healthcare silo, the time and attention that we are taking to publicly working through this issue, I think it speaks to the quality of the work that we're doing on a bipartisan basis on this issue. It is very, very easy. Let me tell you, it is easy to just say, let's just keep it like it is, and there are things to worry about. But then you look at it, and you realize that when we say $36 billion, it's almost such a big number that you lose sight of what that means. I mean, $36 billion in this year's budget related to Medicaid. And Lord only knows what that number will be at the end of this current procurement cycle when we're all back home doing whatever we're doing in 2030. I promise you it will be much more than $36 billion. So the work we're doing now really is, you know, planting a tree that someone else will enjoy the shade. We're doing the work right now to make sure that our legislative successors here, as we approach 2030, can hopefully look at this and say we've done some good work. There's 5 million Floridians who this impacts. 60% of the children, 6 out of every 10 kids in the state of Florida, is impacted by this. So it's a huge amount of money. It's a huge amount of responsibility. And again, I want to commend every member of this committee and the committees before and the entire House for doing the hard work of making a good bill better. Last thing I'll say is as to the comments from my friend Representative Duran, Representative Brown, I really echo what you're saying. You know, we all have stories of impacts that, some of these essential provider hospitals have had in our life. I remember, I'll never forget driving to Wolfson's Children's Hospital in Jacksonville with my 8-year-old, whose blood sugar was 4 times what it would be in a normal circumstances, you know, having to think that, you know, my life changed on that day. Because I know we all have stories from our families' lives of the importance of these essential providers. And so the goal of all this is not to, you know, put one side or the other. There's a business of healthcare that we all have to manage and make sure we're managing well to provide the highest quality care at the lowest possible cost. But ultimately, we're doing all this because for those 5 million Floridians, for those 60% of children in Florida, to make sure they have access to the life-saving care that is so important for all of us. So with that, I ask for your favorable support of this good bill and for your continued efforts with me to make it a great bill. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Garrison. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Avila?
Yes.
Vice Chair Tribuzzi?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Ranking Member Brown?
Yeah, no. No, 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 no.
Almost, almost.
Still time.
Representatives Duran?
No.
Representative Garrison?
Yes.
Harding?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Salzman?
Yes.
Saroy?
Yes.
Skidmore?
No.
Sorry?
No.
Representative Smith?
No.
Snyder?
Yes.
Woodson?
No.
Yarbrough? Yes. 10 yeas, 5 nays.
Thank you, Sabrina, and thank you, members. Please show that bill passes, and by your vote, that bill will be reported favorably.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Garrison. Members, just wanted to say, and again, wanted to thank Representative Garrison, Representative Onchowski that was here earlier with us, you know, for those two good pieces of policy that we'll be moving on in our committee. I wanted to thank all the committee members again for their engagement, their debate, their questions, their passion on this issue within the healthcare space. You know, one thing that I did want to mention is everything in healthcare, you know, is constantly changing. And, you know, with that, we can't expect to be 100% on board with everything in terms of it needs to be either 100% perfect or I can't support it. As we all know, even with our own spouses, we probably don't agree with 60% of the time. Yet we share a house and have children, right? So what I mean by that is let's, as we say in the military, hunt for the good stuff, right? And work with the sponsors to try to get the best possible product to move forward, and you know, keep that collaboration, keep that going in this process. That's what makes this process great. So, with that being said, members, this concludes our subcommittee meeting. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Woodson moves that we rise without objection. This meeting is adjourned.